Jonah Fizz.
What?
I have no idea.
Yes, show enough. This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of Show Enough Cinema.
Yes.
With your great hosts. Sorry, your great host, Dave White, of Movies.com fame. Mm-hmm. And your other host, Alonzo Duralde, of somewhere. I don't know.
You're the worst. Which means I'm greater than you.
Alonzo You're from TheRap.com.
TheRap.com.
And What the Flick.
And What the Flick. And according to somebody on Facebook, I have millions.
Millions.
Of fans.
Millions.
Millions.
You probably do.
No.
Maybe.
No.
How do you know you don't? How do you know you don't?
I'm pretty sure.
Look, you've got how many Twitter followers? Like 5,000? That's a lot.
I don't have enough Twitter
followers.
For
every one Twitter follower, that could be like a million. That one Twitter follower could represent a million people.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's not how it works.
Out there in the actual world who don't have Twitter capabilities.
Capap, no.
Capillaries.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Hey, Alonzo Duralde of TheRap.com, who sponsors Linoleum Knife?
Linoleum Knife is brought to you by No Budget Film School. No Budget Film School presents its famed Art and Science of No Budget Filmmaking class on May 3rd and 4th in Los Angeles. Veteran indie producer and No Budget Film School founder Mark Stolaroff teaches the specific methods, models, and priorities of successful No Budget Filmmaking in this unique, one-of-a-kind class. If you're ready to make a movie, if you're tired of chasing money, tired of asking for permission to make your movie, then this will be the most practical filmmaking class you will ever take. Stolaroff will teach you how to make a film with whatever resources you have available to you right now. These cutting-edge techniques cannot be found at film school, in other film classes, or anywhere else. Stolaroff will be joined by several guest speakers, including distribution expert Peter Broderick, and post-production maven Matt Radicke of the Indie Post House, Different by Design. Several other guests will be announced soon. Past guest speakers included Joe Carnahan, David Gordon Green, Jody Hill, Ty West, Jay Duplass, Sean Baker, Drake Doremus, Destin Cretton, Alex Karpovsky, and many others. You can register at nobudgetfilmschool.eventbrite.com or visit the website nobudgetfilmschool.com. Save 20% when you use special promotional code Linoleum. Students with a valid ID save even more.
You did that better than I did last week.
Well, you know.
You did it for real?
I did it instead of
the dumb way that I did it.
Seriously, use that code Linoleum. Because that's how they know that you heard about it from us.
When are the dates again? You read it. You did read it very quickly. When are the dates?
May 3rd and 4th.
May 3rd and 4th is No Budget Film School.
Mm-hmm.
NoBudgetFilmSchool.com.
Correct.
Yeah. See, here's the difference. Okay. So I'm terrible at making up advertisements and reading the sponsor stuff. But here's what I am. Here's where I am good. Here's the one thing I'm good at.
You meander.
Being slow. I'm real good at being slow and repeating things again and again for reinforcement. See, I used to be a middle school teacher where I would go slowly and repeat things again and again, such as the fact that No Budget Film School is on whatever dates it's on.
May 3rd and 4th.
May 3rd and 4th, and you should go to nobudgetfilmschool.com.
Well,
on the other hand,
is on May 3rd and 4th. They do stuff
very,
all the time.
You, on the other hand, are very fast.
I am fast.
You zip right through the thing, but you do it in a way that is like a grown-up.
Well, also, because this is a podcast, people could rewind if they really needed to.
Oh, I forgot about that. They could, couldn't they?
It's like Tebow.
We're very happy that they've sponsored us.
Yes, we appreciate it.
We want to do right by them. Maybe I will do it right the next time.
Maybe.
Maybe I could be the one to actually behave like an announcer who has a sponsor.
It's going to take some getting used
to. Let's see about that for next time.
We've been alone in the wilderness for so long.
We don't know how to act anymore.
We have no idea. But we're learning. We're getting it right.
No, you're learning. I can't be tamed. Can't be learned. Can't be tamed. That's right.
You couldn't be tamer, frankly.
Whatever are you saying? He said,
sipping his tea.
Sipping his PG tips. eating the last of his little sugared lavender cookies.
Violet.
Sugared violet cookies.
Okay, so...
I don't know what's happening.
Every week...
Oh, wait, I should look at our thing.
See, every week I tell Dave White, hey, we should write down the movies.
No, I did that. Because otherwise, we'll forget something.
Like, for example, last week...
No.
Where we completely forgot...
Here it is.
...to mention...
Look.
Nymphomaniac.
Nymphomaniac. Look, it's right up at the top. Nymphomaniac.
Yeah, it is now, because we forgot it last week.
So... This is a documentary about a complete slut.
Stop. It's funny. TCM showed...
Here's the internet headline. Film podcast, slut shames.
Charlotte Gainsbourg. TCM screened Sam Fuller's Shock Corridor last night.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
That's such a great movie.
Yeah, it's a movie about this guy who goes undercover in an insane asylum to crack a story and winds up losing his mind himself. There's a scene where he accidentally wanders into the women's wing and is attacked by what he calls nymphos. So that's what I always think of when I see Nymphomaniac.
Yeah, when I say the word slut... Or nympho, or hua, for example. It's coming from a place of admiration.
Okay.
I'm pro all of these things. Are you a slut, a nympho, or a hua? I'm your friend. That is why, like our friend Aaron, who I had this discussion with this morning while we had breakfast.
Uh-huh.
At the original Pancake House in Orange County. Mm-hmm. Y'all, really go down there and get those apple pancakes.
They're not sponsoring this show.
So good. Well, maybe they will someday. You don't know.
Anything is possible.
Yeah. He said he wanted there to be a part three.
Yes, he said that on Facebook.
He wanted to have weekly visits with Joe. That's the name of the character played by Charlotte Gainsbourg. I think he wants to have weekly visits with Charlotte Gainsbourg. That's what he wants. I don't think he necessarily wants to hang around with a woman that's like humping the furniture and stuff, which is what she does.
Yeah.
In this film.
Nymphomaniac, it's the latest film from Lars von Trier. And it is currently being released in the United States as a two-parter, because it's a four-hour movie, basically.
In the Europe, it's all out at once, apparently.
Right. Yeah. But our attention spans can't handle it. So Nymphomaniac Volume 1 is currently playing theatrically in limited release, and it's also on demand.
Yeah.
And Nymphomaniac Volume 2 is currently on demand and opens in theaters this coming Friday, April 4th.
This 4th, yeah. This next, yeah.
But
You can watch all of it at home.
Right. On the sofa with a loved one.
I guess eventually, like after this Friday, you could go to a theater and watch it back to back if you wanted to.
If the one theater is showing both movies.
You know someone will.
Oh, I'm sure, but...
In Los Angeles, anyway.
Well,
if you live in the middle of nowhere, you're out of luck.
Right.
You just got to watch it at home.
Right. I'm wondering, though, like, if... Would it be the kind of thing where they could show both on one screen, or would they have to have them on different screens and you just hop from one to the other, or buy two... I don't know. They would have to charge two admissions. You have to go buy two tickets. Yeah.
And then time it properly.
Right.
And then... Do a sexy dance as you make your way from one theater to the next.
But here's the thing.
Everybody who goes must do...
This is a movie...
A sexy dance.
This is a movie about...
As they make their
way. This is a movie about
sex. From part one to part two.
That ain't sexy at all.
That's your matter of opinion, ain't it?
Do you think it was sexy?
No.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it is a movie about a woman who is... Well, she rejects the label sex addict or sexually compulsive.
She does.
She prefers to think of herself as a nymphomaniac.
Correct. In the classical sense.
Right.
Of, you know, uncontrollable.
Libido.
Untamed.
Yes.
Like myself.
Have another violet cookie.
She starts out the film saying that she discovered her C at age 2.
Yes.
and immediately began.
That would be her see you next Tuesday.
Yeah, her playing with herself, basically, right. From childhood on. Thankfully, you don't see any of that stuff in the film.
We did have the conversation.
There are limits.
What do they tell the little girl who is lying on the ground and suddenly levitating and having to make
funny faces? Yeah. I don't know how he directed to that. Although I remember when Mysterious Skin came out.
Oh, right. Yeah.
There were interviews with Greg Araki, and he was talking about how, you know, it was a very, very delicate thing to direct a child, an 8 or 9 year old boy, in a scene where it is clear that to the audience that the child is being molested.
Right.
But that obviously that's not happening on camera, and but you have to get the reaction of the child, the face react. And I remember him saying that. Basically, they explained to the kid, look, this man is hurting you in the movie. And so I want you to look scared and like someone is going to hurt you. And that was the direction. Mm-hmm. And so that was how they did it.
Well, and there's, and,
you know, probably the kid still hasn't probably seen this movie.
It was, what, 1995?
Was it that long ago?
Yeah.
No.
Yes. Yes.
95? No. Like 2005.
Sorry, I mean, yeah. Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah, well, your kid's probably seen the movie by now. Yeah.
Yeah, no, because...
And then gone to his parents and said, what did you let me do?
Sorry, yes.
What crazy movie did you let me be in?
2005, because it came out the same year as 101. Like, I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's also the story, and I think we may have talked about it a couple of weeks, when the remake came out, that when Franco Zeffirelli was directing Endless Love,
yes,
that he would squeeze Brooke Shields' big toe.
Right.
And that was how he got, like,
the O-face.
O-faces out of her.
Yeah.
Because she didn't know.
That's weird. Like, that's not cool. I don't think that's cool at all. I think Brooke Shields grew up in a weird time.
Well, she was, what, 15 or 16 by that point?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like a 7-year-old kid. I mean,
right, she was at least already...
She understood what it was that she was supposed to be approximating. She just, you know, even if she had never done it yet, she knew that, you know...
But I'm talking about her...
She'd been in Pretty Baby by
that's
that
what
point.
I'm saying. Like, she grew up in a very strange time in the culture.
Yes.
Where that... Where the idea in film that a child would be sexualized...
Right.
Was just something that no one said, okay, well, you can't explore that idea
right
in a film. Because Louis Malle was just like, well, that's what we're going to do. You know, she's 10 or whatever, and she's going to play a 10-year-old prostitute.
That was a good, at least 10 years or so after Lolita, so it wasn't like nobody had, you know.
I know that, but Lolita was a much different movie.
Definitely.
Yeah. So anyway, back to Nymphomaniac.
Nymphomaniac, yes.
But we digress.
We do. So the film begins. Stellan Skarsgård discovers Charlotte Gainsbourg broken and bleeding in an alleyway.
Right. Brings her in, gives her the giganticest cup of tea in the world. I took note.
She won't let him call the cops or call an ambulance. But yeah, so he brings her upstairs, gives her... And I said, well, look, she's got 2 movies worth of exposition
to get
through.
Storytelling to go through,
you give her the tankard of tea.
Big cup of tea.
And she begins telling her sort of sexual...
Her life story.
Her sexual history. In my review on therap.com, I called her a Scheherazade of the genitals.
Wow.
And, you know, in part one...
And then you made the pun husky face. The
Google pun husky if you haven't already seen that one. In part one, all of her stories seem to stem from things that are in Skarsgård's very Spartan apartment. So there's a fly fishing lure. There's a Bach cassette, a cake fork.
He's got books and peeling wallpaper and not much else.
Right. Yeah. But there's various things that sort of prompt memories from her, which he then in turn sort of, his character is a virgin, but he sort of interprets things that she talks about in terms of how they relate to the Fibonacci sequence or the strategies of fly fishing.
Or musical harmonic theories. And,
right.
It's everything she does, he...
desexualizes.
He finds something analogous in art or music or math or...
botany or whatever. Yeah. And so it's funny because at first I thought, is she going to be Kaiser Soze? Is she just making this stuff up based on what's in the room? So the movie takes part one takes us through mostly her childhood and young adult years. So a lot of the in the flashback stuff, the character is played by an actress named Stacey Martin. As you know, sort of a ripe adolescent and young adult who eventually falls in love with her. Well, she loses her virginity to Shia LaBeouf, to a character played by Shia LaBeouf. And then years later, he winds up being her boss, and she becomes smitten with him. And part one sort of leaves you at an interesting turning point in their relationship. And then part two kind of...
Now Charlotte Gainsbourg is playing Charlotte Gainsbourg.
Right. Well, there's still quite a bit of stuff with where it's still Stacey Martin.
No, I know.
And then eventually it becomes Charlotte Gainsbourg in her own story. And I don't know if it's that... It's just like with, you know, when you're talking about how... Like, for example, we always talk about how in trilogies, the second movie is always the best one because they don't... All the initial exposition is out of the way.
Yes.
And they don't have to, you know, like, wrap everything up. So it's just pure sensation and, like, action and things, you know.
Yes.
I don't know if that's why or if it's... I liked part one better than part two. But by the end of part two, I kind of felt like... I wasn't expecting this was going to go anywhere specific. I didn't think there was going to be some sort of turning point where we, you know, where there's some big answer as to why she is this way or that anybody was going to learn anything or there's going to be any sort of thing. So that was never in my mind. But I didn't find the resolution particularly satisfactory. And in fact, it seemed kind of, well, we got to end this somehow.
We're not going to tell you how it ends.
We're not going to tell you how it ends. But no. that kind of put me off a bit. But both parts are worth seeing. There's a lot of interesting stuff in both. I think, you know, it's... I don't know. It's an interesting film, obviously, in the Von Trier, you know, oeuvre in terms of...
Is that how you say that word? Oeuvre.
Oeuvre or oeuvre. This is the third film in a row that he's made with Charlotte Gainsbourg. I did not care for Antichrist, but I really liked Melancholia.
You're wrong.
Yeah, whatever. And
Antichrist is great.
Yeah, so you say. It's junk. I don't know. I think there's I found this character really fascinating.
I don't understand how you can say Antichrist is junk when it's so intimately sort of tied to this film.
Well,
ideas about women and sexuality and their sanity and their agency and consequences and all that stuff. They are discussed in Antichrist and in this film. So
a lot of filmmakers explore the same subject matter over and over again. They don't always come out the same way.
I understand that.
This is a much better film than Antichrist.
Actually, I think it's sort of maybe even a tamer film than Antichrist.
Well, it is less bilious than Antichrist for sure. It's less, you know, loathing of humanity than Antichrist was. Sorry if that's if that brings it down for you.
It kind of does.
Yeah, well, sorry. No talking foxes in this one either. Spoiler.
I like my Lars von Trier real misanthropic. That's what I like.
When isn't he? What film can you point at and be like, oh, this is the softer side of Lars von Trier? They're all misanthropic. Except maybe The Idiots or something.
Okay.
But generally speaking, he's... Oh, Lars. But no, I
think this is really...
I recommend both halves.
Yeah,
but I like the first half
better. I think it's a really powerful...
Sorry.
Hey, Slurpee. Have a little more iced coffee, Slurpee. Slurpee McGee.
Go on.
No, this is a really powerful movie where you've got as your central the character, a person who does not give one single F about anything or anybody.
Or rather, gives thousands of them.
And well, no, but no, no, not in any substantive way. No. And so I like the idea that this actually thoroughly sort of unlikable person who mm-hmm. does not nice things to people.
Well, she's telling the story in a way to illustrate that she is an awful person. Right. She's trying to convince Stellan Skarsgård that she's awful.
And yet at the same time, the film is asking you to take the ride with her.
And have compassion for her.
And have compassion for her and be on her team.
Mm-hmm.
Her sex team. So,
and that's a deep bench.
It's worth the investment of time, I'd say.
For me, best part of the whole movie, Uma Thurman.
Well, yeah. Worst part of the movie is the gallery of penises.
Those were pretty bad.
That look like they come from some sort of medical textbook. Like, they aren't diseased. They're just
ugly.
Ugly. Like, the ugliest penises
yeah.
that you will see in succession in a film.
It would take several lifetimes to naturally encounter
that many ugly penises.
Unless you're a urologist.
Right. We should talk to your brother and ask him, what's the ratio of ugly penises to not ugly penises in the world? In the world of urology.
I don't know that he even has an aesthetic about that sort of thing, if he ever did. I imagine it's a sort of thing like where you're a gynecologist after a while, they just all sort of blur together, yeah. You know. Anyway, Uma Thurman has this amazing scene in Volume 1. She plays the wife of one of the many lovers that Stacey Martin / Charlotte Gainsbourg has.
Yeah.
And she, you know, Stacey Martin is basically trying to get rid of him. And so she tells him, oh, we need to break it off. I can't stand just having you, you know, once a week. Like, you know, right. I know you can't leave your wife. And I, you know, but so we just need to end it. And then he comes back half an hour later with a suitcase. It's like, okay, yeah. I've left her. And she's... And then Uma Thurman shows
kidding.
Up. Yeah, she doesn't say that.
It was a trick.
And then Uma Thurman shows up with their three kids in tow and is alternately like pathetic and sarcastic and furious. And it is right up there with with Beatrice Straight's
in Network.
Yeah. In Network, her great tell off of William Holden. I mean, it's about a 5-minute performance, but wow. And somebody was, some review.
Get the word whoring bed out of that one. Yes.
Some review that didn't like the movie at all slammed her as being like really? Shrieky or whatever. Like, are you kidding me?
She was terrific.
No, she's great. Uma Thurman, and this is not like shades of Uma Thurman you've ever seen, I think, before in a movie. So great. Worth seeing just for her. But yeah, I would say see both halves, but just two may leave you a little colder than one.
Speaking of obsessive people.
Yes.
Noah.
He built
an arky.
Get those animals out of the muddy. Yes.
Right.
I'm going to let you explain what happens in this one, but I don't know if you saw what Gariana, our friend who used to co-host the Popcorn Mafia podcast, posted on Facebook. She said that having somebody explain the plot of Noah to you is like listening to a Bible story from a mental patient.
The funny thing about the actual Bible story is that it's very spare. There's God's angry. He's going to send a flood. He tells Noah. Tells Noah how to build the ark, how big to make it, what to do, and then to get in it. And then 40 days later, the bird comes back with the olive branch. And then the water dries, they leave, Noah
gets drunk,
gets naked, the sun sees him, which results in him being cursed, and that is why slavery happens, and then the end.
Apparently, so one thing I picked up in all this...
You've got a lot of
there's more Noah
bullet points to hang a lot of other stuff on.
Genesis is not the only place where Noah pops up. Apparently there's other... stories in the Torah.
Yeah.
So it's, you know.
Right. But Genesis is basically the story.
Yes. The nitty-gritty.
Yeah. So so there's a whole lot of other things in Noah. There are fallen angels that have turned into rock monsters.
Yes. Much like the enemies of the GoBots.
There are animated snakes and glowy snake skin and glowy fingers. After you wrap your arm in the glowy snake skin, your finger glows and you touch things and it makes them magic. And then there are those burning rocks that start fires.
Yeah, the pebbles that when crushed form, cause fire to happen.
And then there are the magical plants that sprout.
Right, from the seed that forms a fountain forms a forest.
The scaly dog-like creature that apparently does not get on the ark.
Yes. No, I wrote down armadillo dog in my notes.
There are a variety of supernatural visions and dreams that are not part of the Old Testament story.
There are two races of people. One of which is Noah being the last one,
right,
of the line of Seth, and everybody else being a descendant of Cain,
right, led by Ray Winston,
and
was mean. And those people are constantly setting things on fire, tossing animals in the air, eating the animals alive, and raping each other
and exploiting natural resources.
Yeah,
guess who doesn't survive the flood?
That's right. Vegan Noah, however,
yes,
who is a caretaker of every living plant,
mm-hmm,
he, without even trying, he's not even the one who gets them on. Like, he doesn't have to go out and collect the animals.
No.
They sort of magnetically are drawn to the ark. And the day the snakes all come, Jennifer Connelly, who plays Mrs. Noah, she's like, do we have to have the snakes here? You know, like, and I'm with her on that. The snakes are like, yeah, we're here. We have a reservation on this air ark. And everyone except Noah is looking at the snakes like, oh, come on, snakes. Why the snakes?
Look,
and
how many rats do you want in the post-flood world? You want some snakes.
I know. But then they had to have rats on, too. All the species of rats had to get on that ark.
And their only explanation for why they don't all eat each other is that
they
apparently
sleep. They hibernate.
That Noah and Mrs. Noah are like anesthesiologists with
homeopathic variety.
Exactly. That was what I wanted. They're homeopathic anesthesiologists.
Yeah.
Because, like, that was the one thing in this story that needed some scientific explanation.
Right. Well, I think what's great is that I think it's a great idea that the animals all sort of become drowsy for the entire time. And they all sleep the entire time.
Like sections of the audience.
Yeah. So that's the mechanics of this. And what I really dig about this movie, in the way that I dig other Darren Aronofsky movies, is that this is about an obsessive person whose obsession becomes such a problem for him that he no longer understands what is driving him. Is his obsession driving him, or is God actually still talking to him?
Right.
We don't call God God in this movie, by the way. They keep calling God the Creator.
Well, this is pre-Abraham, so
yes.
He'd never
and
made
so
it.
I know there are people complaining about that, but that's because they don't know the Old Testament. They don't mention God in the book of Esther either, by the way.
These are the people that complain about Xmas when that was actually an abbreviation created by Christians.
I know. So the great thing about this film for me, other than the spectacle of it, which I completely appreciated and was never bored by and had a great time watching, is the idea that what if you're crazy?
What if God isn't talking to you?
What if you're just a lunatic? And I know that's offensive to some people, but you know what? Life is offensive.
Well,
life does crazy things.
Here's the thing,
though.
If you have your magic seed that turns into a fountain, that turns into a forest, and you have a bunch of rock-covered angels helping you build this thing, that seems like kind of a stamp of approval that maybe God is actually talking to you.
Maybe.
But
what if God goes silent, which is what happens during the film?
Sure, yeah.
God goes silent to Noah. No longer gets messages from God, but then gets it in his own head.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have to kill everybody. So, I'm sorry, that's a bit of a spoiler, but not super much of one.
Yeah, the twist here is that Noah's interpretation of his instructions is that basically he and his family are to be the last
of people.
The human race.
And if God wants to start humans over again, he'll do that.
He'll start fresh.
Yeah.
That basically they're as the caretakers of the innocent animals, and that once their job is done, they will die off and go away, and that'll be it.
In 900 years.
Exactly.
Because that's how long people lived in the Old Testament. They all lived to be 900 years
just
old.
Just to paper over gaps in history.
Yes.
Here's why you're crazy. No, I.
Why don't you tell me why I am crazy?
No,
tell me what's wrong with me and my beautiful mind. See what I did there?
I did see what you did there.
Yeah.
Now, this movie gotten better reviews than I thought it was going to.
That's because we're right and you're wrong.
No, actually. For me, this movie felt like constantly. There was a constant sense of compromise about it. I didn't feel like it was sort of unfettered Darren Aronofsky, you know, obsessive stuff, you know, working with the Bible story.
I agree with you to an extent. Keep going.
You know, so to me it felt like there was some of that in there, but they didn't want to take it too far because if you're going to spend however many kajillion dollars he somehow talked Paramount to coughing
up
for this thing.
That's right.
Paramount's being all... want to get some of that Passion of the Christ money in,
right.
Which means not
they're not
offending.
They're no, not they're getting not. That. They're getting the curiosity seekers.
Yeah, like
out of that demographic.
They don't. They don't want to offend the Kirk Cameron audience, which they're gonna anyway.
Right.
And so I kind of feel like neither the Kirk Cameron audience nor the Aronofsky audience is going to come away with this feeling like they got what they wanted.
Well, I'm both.
I
am the Kirk Cameron audience and the Darren Aronofsky audience.
And I find it kind of muddled and dull, frankly. There are long stretches of this movie that were just draggy and, you know.
I thought it was beautiful. It looks beautiful. It's
well shot by Matthew Libatique, but even that it is visually such a gray palette. I mean, by necessity, I get it. There weren't a lot of... You know, there wasn't a lot of hot pink in the Old Testament. But, you know, I don't know. I was just kind of... I found it hard to get involved or to care about it. The characters didn't seem all that deep. And the thing is, when you make this kind of story, this story specifically, out of the Bible, you find that you have to start thinking literally about things like, wait, how did they repopulate the earth? And why does it matter if the middle sun gets banished when there's no one on the entire planet? Like if his whole thing is
go 5 minutes away.
Exactly. If you want to be exiled, like literally go over that hill. We'll just pretend you're not there. So I don't know. I just was not into it. I think there's a lot of great stuff about it. There's a lot of cool visual things. There are some interesting ideas about, you know, the whole idea of Noah's obsession and you know, thinking that the humanity needed to die off.
I like that element of madness.
Yeah.
It's not as wild as The Fountain, which is maybe my favorite Darren Aronofsky movie. But nothing will ever be as wild as The Fountain.
Sure.
Because I don't think he'll ever let himself
go that crazy. Yeah, no studio is ever going to let him do that again.
Yeah.
And then you know, I liked the lava angels. You know, I mean, I thought there were some interesting notes here. But overall, I just found it kind of a slog. And I felt like it wasn't anybody's unfettered vision. Neither Aronofsky's nor his backers.
It was trippy enough to make me happy. If we're just going to talk straight up theological standpoint here, mm-hmm. I think anytime anybody interprets this stuff in a creative way and gets up the noses of the people who think they own it,
mm-hmm.
the world is a better place.
Granted.
Yeah. You don't own that stuff. Whoever you are. You think you do, you don't.
And
so...
And after millennia, it's like, you know...
Right.
It's open to some interpretation and some, you know... clarification, whatever you want, you know.
Right. Alonso?
Dave?
Who else sponsors linoleumknife.com? Not .com. Well, I mean, we could...
We'll
say they sponsor linoleumknife.com too, since linoleum-knife.com
is us
as well as Linoleum Knife, the podcast.
Right. Why don't you tell me?
I would love to. the real truth, everything you didn't know you need to know about making an independent film.
By Reed Martin.
By Reed Martin, from Faber and Faber, where you should buy wherever they got books, whether it be Costco or Walmart or the internet or an actual bookstore.
There's still a few of those left.
That isn't Barnes & Noble. Maybe one that's got one of those dumb bookstore cats wandering around making everybody allergic and sneezing. How that ever became a thing. I'm sure they're lovely animals. You know, someone's going to yell at me for...
Yeah, no, I believe me.
I can't go into those places if they got too many cats in
them. No, I see a bookstore cat and I'm immediately going to whatever section is on the far end of the store because I don't want my eyes to start itching.
Right. Anyway, the book contains three very detailed and reconciled indie film production budgets. Do you know what reconciled means?
When you reconcile a budget, it's where you take what you initially projected things would cost versus what they actually did cost, and also what you projected you would take in versus what you actually take in.
That's correct. You know things about independent film.
I know things about budgets.
That you need to know before you make one.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you know. Did you read this book?
I have not read it yet, to be honest, but the parts that we've been talking about I find really fascinating.
Well, this is something you will not find in most other books on indie filmmaking because they either don't have access to real budgets
mm-hmm.
of films that were actually made or because the books are terrible and dumb.
Well, yes. There's a lot of that.
Sorry. Because the books want to sell you. He didn't write that. It's not the coffee. The books want to sell you on the ridiculous notion that you can make an independent film for an unrealistically low amount of money.
Ah.
Like, you could make El Mariachi for $7,000, or you could make Jonathan Coed.
Tarnation.
You could make Tarnation for 37 cents, like, on your computer.
Right.
The Real Truth by Reed Martin will show you exactly how much you need at three different budget levels and three different budget levels and, more importantly, what you need to spend your money on.
Hmm.
No matter how you raised it, Kickstarter or whatever.
Your mom.
Film budgets are a thing that a lot of critics in the mainstream press talk about, and increasingly so do regular folks. Why do they do that? It's not something that I care about as
it's a thing a that it became an anecdote. You know, the brothers McMullen and Clerks a lot, and it was, right. Really, it all started with El Mariachi.
I know.
You know, that's why I love that Joe Queenan's book, The Unkindest Cut, where he set out to make a movie that was even cheaper than El Mariachi.
Right. Here's the part I like about the copy where he talks about, because I that whole like people who think that's a cool thing to talk mm-hmm. about.
Yeah.
I don't care about that, but I do like this. He says, when a film is in trouble these days, you'll hear that the budget of this or that film was $200 million or far north of $200 million, as was the case with World War Z. And it's often code for, this movie is in trouble. Now, whenever the trades start reporting that the budget is now north of $200 million, and folks who think they know better, they like to, you know, make fun of movies or start attacking films that are made for absurd amounts of money. I think that's an interesting outgrowth of this budget obsession.
Right.
But did you know?
What?
Did you?
Ask the question.
Yes.
Did I know what?
Do you know that the movies that go over the budget the most and the hardest and the worst, what those movies are? What do you think? Do you think that they are the $200 million movies, or do you think that they are the $200,000 movies?
I'm going to say it's the low-budget indie.
It's not what you're thinking. It's the low-budget indie.
Aha! Foiled again.
Those first and second indie films, those are the ones that ruin themselves with their budgets.
Mm.
Because here's what happens. When you make, let's say, you make Waterworld.
Mm.
And then you're like, oh no. Waterworld cost $500 billion to make. What are we going to do? I know what we're going to do. We're going to re-release it in China under the name Big American Red Cup Pool Party. Then it's going to make $500 billion. And boom, World is no longer a flop because it's now called Big American Red Cup Pool Party. But then what you have is a movie like, what was that terrible movie about Zoe Deschanel and the Mattresses? What was that movie called? Do you remember that movie?
Oh, God. I didn't see it. You did.
Such a terrible movie. What was that movie?
I don't.
Something about Zoe Deschanel and the Mattresses.
Right.
Gigantic? Was that the name of it?
I think you might have been Gigantic, yes.
And Paul Dano, was he in it too?
Probably.
I don't know how much.
He's in all those movies.
I can't imagine that movie made more than 35 cents. But I bet you it cost. I bet you it cost about $500,000. Just a guess.
Yes, Gigantic. Paul Dano, Zoe Deschanel.
Yeah. Something about Mattresses. That's all I remember from that movie. It's so bad.
Yeah.
Who made that film? Did you just turn down the thing?
Hang on. 2008. Somebody named Matt Azelton.
And what has he done since?
He directed something on TV called Robin Banks and the Bank Robbers.
Okay. Is that it?
Or the Bank Roberts. I can't tell. Oh, and he had something to do with the Dr. Bronner's documentary.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
That was a cool documentary.
He was the executive producer of Dr. Bronner's Magic Soapbox.
Well, I don't know this guy at all, so I'm not going to really blame him for Gigantic, because maybe something happened to make it bad. But, I mean, did it make money? Did it go somewhere? I don't think it did. Right?
I don't think anyone remembers that movie. Yeah. And you didn't even remember the title of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I bet you that movie probably lost some money. They could not name that movie Big American Red Cup Pool Party. And because people would go see that and think, wait a second, there's no pool party.
There's no red cups.
No red cups. I want my money back.
I want my $500 billion back.
I paid $500 billion for my ticket, and now I want it back.
But we digress.
Yes. Anyway, so are you an aspiring filmmaker? You shouldn't think that it's just the Hollywood studio films that burn through all their cash trying to fix the things that should have been thought of at the script stage. Most indie films are bigger disasters, dollar for dollar, than The Lone Ranger. And this is what the real truth can help you avoid. All the Ricky Mistukes. That you will make when you go over budget with your indie film. Don't make Ricky Mistukes. Read this book and it will help you. It will help you pronounce rookie mistakes better than me. And it will help you not make the rookie mistakes or the Ricky Mistukes.
Ricky Mistukes should be like a drag king name.
I've changed my mind. I no longer want to be known as Candy Face. I want everyone to call me Ricky Mistukes. Keep up. So, go get this book.
The Real Truth, Everything You Didn't Know You Needed to Know About Making an Independent Film by Reed Martin, available from Faber & Faber.
The end of ad copy for this week.
Yes.
I think I did mine just as good as you did yours, but qualitatively differently.
Yes. Yes.
That's what I think.
Yes. You have a genius for improv.
Somebody better buy this book because of me. Because here's what's going to have to happen. If nobody buys this book based on our really good advertising.
Yes.
We have to give Reed Martin his sponsorship money back. So you jerks and dum-dums better go buy this book.
He cares enough to pay for this show.
Also, he cared enough to write a book for you.
Yes.
The least you can do is go buy it.
Read it.
And pretend to read it. Then go make a movie.
Yes.
And when it's a big success, you come back to Reed Martin. Personally, you say, you know what, Reed Martin? I owe it all to you. And The Real Truth, R-E-E-L.
And I only knew about your valuable book.
Because of Linoleum Knife.
That's right.
The podcast of the cinema. What movie are we talking about next?
I have no idea.
Sabotage. It stinks.
It stinks. Boy, does it stink. I did not see Escape Plan, but based on this and whatever that one with Johnny Knoxville was, Like,
what was Escape Plan? What was that?
Escape Plan was Schwarzenegger and Stallone.
Oh, that was whatever.
And then what
it was a lot of whatever.
What was the Johnny Knoxville one? The Last
Eat Stand? My Dust.
The Last Something.
I don't remember.
The Last Bagel.
Something.
Yeah, just
Ricky Mastooks
and the Last Bagel
and the guns ablazing.
Schwarzenegger's post-gubernatorial film career has been a real downer.
He is making films to fill his calendar. He's making movies to keep himself busy. He's making movies because there are no Planet Hollywoods for him to go around, like, opening. He's making movies because Cigar Aficionado did not take off the way it was supposed to.
And he does not like to play golf, I guess.
I bet he does.
Well,
I bet he plays a lot of golf.
Not enough to keep him from making dopey movies like this one. And this is directed by David Ayer, who just did End of Watch, which was
really cool.
A movie that I enjoyed quite a bit. So this movie's a disappointment in many ways.
These guys are DEA agents and they're dirtbags and they steal $10 million. But then the money disappears. The money disappears. Someone steals the money from them. They get
internal investigated.
That goes away because they get bored with investigating them and nobody cracks. Then, one by one, they start dying. And the film picks off its decent character actors one at a time until very few of them are left. In spectacularly
bloody fashion.
Yeah, until very few of them are left, plus Schwarzenegger. So, the most inert, boring human being in the film is the one that gets to live. And the ones you want to keep watching, they
get hammered to ceilings, disemboweled, out. Yeah. And then
eaten by a cat.
Yeah, and then you've got Olivia Williams, who is a terrific actress. But boy, you know, we always talk about, like, if you watch Hannibal every week and you see, you know, Hugh Dancy as Will Graham, you think, God, those British people,
they sure can't do American accents. They just
nail those American accents. They're so good. Well, Olivia Williams is here to disabuse you of that notion, because her Southern accent is the worst.
It's really weird.
I'm from Atlanta. I know what that's supposed to sound like, and it's not even. It's a different.
I thought she was going for like a Baltimore thing.
I don't know what she was doing. It changed.
Like that weird sort of twangy John Waters, young John Waters, to sound. All like, you know, like that.
We're
going to
go to Detroit and work in the auto industry.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's it changed from scene to scene what she was doing.
It was.
It wasn't even the same. It was bad. So strange. Accent.
Yeah.
This movie's it's cynical and it's slapdash and it's
I would like it
unappealing
if this filmmaker David Ayers had been allowed to do Ayer. Mm-hmm. That was Ayers. Mm-mm. I would like it if he were just allowed to do whatever he wanted to do.
Here's the thing.
Well, I don't think he was allowed to do whatever he wanted to do.
But End of Watch was his third film.
Yes.
I didn't see the first one, which was the one with Christian Bale.
Harsh Times.
I did see...
I kind of barely remember Harsh Times.
I did see Street Kings.
I did not. I don't which is Street Kings.
Terrible.
Oh, really?
It's the one with Keanu Reeves.
I'm trusting in the dude. I'm trusting that he knows what he wants and knows how to get it. And when he doesn't get what he wants, I feel like it might be because someone's in the way.
I've seen one really good movie from him sandwiched between two terrible ones. So now it's like...
But it was good enough that I have faith in him.
But was the good one a fluke? Was the good one re-edited by somebody else? Maybe we're...
Did Jake Gyllenhaal come in and be like, let me direct this from the actor chair?
I mean, I don't know. All I'm saying is Street Kings was terrible and Sabotage is terrible. So David Ayer he's got to prove something.
All right.
Yes. But yeah, this movie is wretched and dull and not well done.
I wish that Schwarzenegger,
who could not be more checked out in this movie.
I wish that he would see what he is doing to cinema and then care. Like, it was a two-pronged approach. First, he must be shown the error of his ways, and then you must force him to care. But I don't think he'll ever be forced to care
Probably not.
About anything that's not right in front of his nose.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter to him.
Once
he
you get to his level,
the check clears, you know.
Once you get to his level, I don't know that you can tell those guys anything.
No. And this, if it weren't for Schwarzenegger being in it, and not for anything he brings up, but just the very nature, the very fact that he is in it, this would be a direct-to-DVD movie.
Yeah.
It's that bad.
Sam Worthington is interesting.
Yeah. He's actually...
Maybe for the first time.
I think he might have, because here he gets to play, it's a supporting role, and he's ugly.
He's got the Colin Farrell role.
Yeah, but he's kind of uglied up. He's got one of those, like, you know, those beards with the rubber bands in it. You
can
know?
Try to ugly up Sam Worthington.
But you know what I'm saying? It's he's not glammed up,
right?
And yeah. So this movie does hold out the promise that Sam Worthington, character actor,
could be a thing.
Could be way more interesting than Sam Worthington, leading man, ever was.
Yeah.
And Maria Ennis.
She's a lot of fun.
Devours the scenery with gusto, and she's a lot of fun to watch.
She knows this is trash.
Yes,
and she's willing.
She revels in it
to get down like that. Yeah,
totally.
So I saw Cesar Chavez.
Yes,
and very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, it's getting very bad reviews.
Really?
Yeah, but I did not dislike it. I felt like it was very focused on the movement, the United Farm Workers movement.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Michael Pena was sort of low key, and that's always a risk.
Sure.
When you're taking that approach to a great person in history.
Right.
I feel like they didn't scattershot themselves all over the map with biopic sort of level psychology.
Mm-hmm.
They focused on this 10-year movement to organize the farm workers in the 60s. And as that, it's a very briskly paced highlights reel of a social movement that was very important and is in danger of being forgotten because of the way things are going now with, you know, the approach to workers and labor.
No, I do appreciate the timing of this movie because it seems
it needs
like,
to be out right now and it needs to be seen.
Yeah, I think the labor movement in this country accomplished so much and is now having so much of it dialed back.
Right.
And has been demonized
right.
for its very existence in a way
right.
that, yeah, people need to know about, you know, all the labor movements. I mean, you know, going back to the formation of the, you know, the AFL-CIO and you know, and yes, Cesar Chavez and organizing that and the you know, the bus boycotts, all that stuff, because, you know, ever since Ronald Reagan, and especially in the last, you know, decade or so,
yes.
it just feels like that the middle class in this country is being systematically destroyed.
Yeah.
You know, and we're being made to feel like that standing up for the rights of workers, for the basic, you know, dignity of working people is somehow this, you know, commie plot, which is back what they used to say back in the day.
That is what they keep saying to him in the film. Well, you're a comp, you're, because it's the 60s, and right. you're a commie, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, it's not a dynamic movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really great moment with America Ferrera as Cesar Chavez's wife,
mm-hmm.
where she gets the exciting Norma Rae
right,
moment.
The swelling music and everything.
She gets the exciting Norma Rae moment. But the film itself is fairly low-key and the kind of thing maybe that you should show in a high school history class.
Gotcha.
It's
directed by Diego Luna.
I know that doesn't make you want to rush out and see it, but I really sort of was engaged from start to finish. And it's, I think it's worthwhile, if for no other reason, then you get to see the archival footage of that rat bastard Ronald Reagan calling the United Farm Workers strike of grapes immoral and blackmail. It's probably not nice to speak ill of the dead, but he was like the worst president we've had in the 20th century.
Yep.
And so,
and it should be noted,
I was around in the 80s, so if you weren't...
It should be noted.
You just don't know.
Ronald Reagan was himself a former union leader.
Yes. President of SAG.
Yep.
When he was an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And then becomes an anti-union.
Antichrist.
Crusader. Yeah. I thought the performances were nice. I thought Michael Peña was good. I like Diego Luna. He's not a showy director.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you feel like he's kind of getting his feet wet as a director. He's made a couple narrative features now and,
right,
like, a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
America Ferrera, her moments are nice. Rosario Dawson, who, as you know, is my lady.
Yes.
She's just in it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Not tons. But she plays Dolores Huerta, who's still alive in her 80s and still an activist. So this is like a jumping off point for learning about stuff. Would you like to know more?
Read more about it.
Go see Cesar Chavez or get the DVD or whatever. You know, like, it ain't bad.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's from that company Pantelion, which is, you know, they've been working with Lionsgate, and they're really targeting films to the Latino market. And I remember I interviewed the people who run that company when they first started, and they were very much about, oh, we don't want to deal with issue movies, and, you know, we they were like, they said, we don't want to make movies about the drug cartels, we want to make romantic comedies, we want to make movies that Hispanic audiences actually want to go see. So I admire the fact that they are putting their clout behind a movie that is an important biopic that isn't, you know, necessarily warm and fuzzy.
It is kind of warm and fuzzy,
but though, you know what I mean. It's not From Prada to Nada.
No, it's not. It's almost as good as From Prada to Nada.
Well, we all aspire to those heights.
So then we saw The Raid 2.
Woo!
Which is no longer called The Raid 2 Berendahl.
No, it's just in this country, it's just called The Raid 2.
Why? Here's the other thing.
Because what is Berendahl?
I don't remember anyone saying the word Berendahl.
Yeah, nobody knows what Berendahl is, so why would they put that in the title?
I don't know.
In the United States, it's just The Raid 2.
Yeah.
And that's all it has to be.
That's all it has to be. Tell the thing. Tell the thing about it.
Okay, so the sole survivor of the raid.
Mm-hmm.
Is put back to work.
Rama.
Played by
Iko Uwe.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He gets another assignment. He is sent...
And I probably didn't say his name right.
He is sent deep undercover. He has to go to jail and befriend the son of another Jakartan crime boss.
Yes.
And spends several years behind bars ingratiating himself and saving the life of said son of crime boss. So when he gets out of jail, he has a job with the organization, only to discover that the son is looking to overthrow the father and disrupt the fragile peace that the father has maintained with the Japanese mafia because of this third party who wants to mess everything up and take control. And then it's fight, 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 fight.
Yes.
And the fight scenes in this movie are breathtaking.
They're staggering, yeah.
This is the kind of excitement that I got from 80s Jackie Chan.
Right.
You know, but before he came back to the United States when he was just
making... Only with extreme murder.
But much bloodier, yes.
I think much bloodier is actually underselling the amount of bloodiness and amount of gore and amount of vicious, brutal, cruel slaughter that takes place in this film.
You are correct in all those fronts, yes. So there's lots of that, but it is stunningly directed and edited by Gareth Evans, who did the first film. He does not fight choreograph this time, but the other two fight choreographers from the first film, one of whom is the star of the film,
yes,
do it again this time. And it's, you know, I remember when Jackie Chan came to Dallas and he talked about how...
What was the context of Jackie Chan coming to Dallas?
Alonso
Duralde, former artistic director of the USA Film Festival in Dallas, Texas, in the years 1995 to 1999. When did Jackie Chan come to Dallas and why?
He came in 1995 when Rumble in the Bronx came out because I invited him.
Yes.
He was in country promoting the film, so he came in. You know, we screened Rumble in the Bronx, and the next day we showed a couple of his early films that he had directed.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about how one of his big inspirations for figuring out how to do a fight scene was musicals.
Yes,
you know, he says, like, you watch Gene Kelly dancing with a newspaper in Summer Stock, and how it's all like bum bum ta 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 ta, you know, and like, you know, the movements, and they were all very timed out, and there was like a rhythm to it. And so it's the same thing when you're two guys who are punching each other or kicking each other in the face. It's like ta ta ta.
Or claw hammering each other.
Or claw hammering each other in the face, as in the case of this movie, or bashing somebody's head in with a baseball bat.
That's correct.
Or
just a baseball.
Oh, I forgot about the baseball.
There is death by baseball.
Oh, man. There is indeed. So, yeah, so Gareth Evans is basically the Arthur Freed of ultraviolence. The Stanley Donen. It's hard to even really talk about this movie. It's a visceral experience. It's not so much about the plot.
It's a 2.5 hour plot, but it's mostly fighting.
Yeah, I mean, you get an idea of who the characters are.
You'll be very tired.
Who the allegiances are. Yeah, it's draining, but I can't think of what you'd cut exactly.
Some of that talky.
Maybe.
You cut some of that talky stuff. I don't care. It's one of the reasons why, as much as I, you know, really dug this movie, I think I may have dug it just a little less than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you don't get that shock of the new.
Sure.
Secondly, the first one for me, the Raid : Redemption,
mm-hmm.
felt pure in that it was about one thing.
Right. Go get the guy.
Go get the guy.
Yeah.
And then fight, 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 fight. The end. This is fight, 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 plot talking, fight, fight, fight. Plot talking. So you get that up and down quality.
Sure.
You get moments of rest.
Yeah, I appreciated the breather. I also appreciated the fact that
but I like a film that is about the one thing.
Sure, no.
I like
both
rigorous attention to face breaking.
I like both movies a lot, but in this movie, for example, you get to have a fight outdoors.
Yes.
Which you didn't get in the first movie, because right. The whole first movie is contained in that building.
It's opened up the fight space, which I did enjoy. I enjoyed bigger, you know, locations for fighting.
And things out in the world.
The one in the mud
is astonishing.
Spectacular.
But, you know, you get to claw hammer people in the face on the subway.
Right.
You know, which in the other movie, again, you were just in that building and you were limited to that. You know, there's... God, I can't wait to talk about Captain America with you.
Yeah.
But there's a great scene in this movie where... there is a very big
fight. Which you have seen and I have not yet seen.
There's a very big fight in a very confined space.
In Captain America?
Yes, but also in the Raid. But also in the Raid too.
Well, yeah.
And it's just, it's really, I love, well, but I mean.
The fight in the very, very, very confined space in the Raid 2 felt mm-hmm. like sort of a nod to the first one for me. But I also feel like it's the least effective fight scene.
Yes, no, absolutely. Yeah. The one in Captain America is stunning. And, of course, I'm just thinking about Nonstop with Liam Neeson in the bathroom.
Yes.
With the other, you know.
That extra, extra large bathroom on the plane.
Yeah, well, it was larger than an airplane bathroom would actually be, but it was still a pretty confined space.
No, I know. I know.
But yeah, I hear what you're saying.
I agree.
Anyway, Raid 2, it is opened limited this weekend. It is expanding over the next couple of weekends. Find it in a theater near you. If you are not down for blood and guts and violence,
don't go
see it, because that's really what that's the selling point here. But if you can live with it, and now believe me, I'm not, unlike Dave, I do not live in a world of...
Yeah, you're kind of a baby man. I'm actually very surprised responded.
I'm not a bloodthirsty like Dave.
These films the way that you have, because
they're well put together. Yeah. They're, you know, this is cinema.
I do thirst. I do thirst for blood.
This is, you know, this pushes my musical buttons in a weird way. It's one number after another.
It's the Goodbye, Mr. Chips of murder.
So, yeah.
1776, a senseless slaughter.
There's one for the poster. What else? What have we
done? That's it.
You're sure?
I'm sure.
Check the list.
Yeah, I did.
And you checked it twice.
Yes.
You're going to find out.
We're done. Nice.
Okay.
Believe me when I tell you things.
All right. My DVD pick this week is pretty poison, because the great Lorenzo Semple Jr. passed away this week. You might have known him from his YouTube review show. I think it was called Old Geezers at the Movies. He wrote some of the best paranoid thrillers of the 1970s, including The 3 Days of the Condor and The Parallax View. He was one of the main creative forces behind the classic Batman TV show of the late 1960s. He wrote Flash Gordon, he wrote the King Kong remake, and he wrote Pretty Poison, which is this wonderfully dark and twisted movie about the, you know, way before David Lynch got there. It's about the sort of evil underside of the, you know, perfect American suburb, with Tuesday Weld as a seemingly all-American drum majorette with, you know, some very with a very dark side, and how she draws Anthony Perkins into her web. Great underrated 60s movie. A lot of people haven't seen it. Pretty Poison, check it out, it's dynamite.
Mine is Wild Combination, A Portrait of Arthur Russell. It's a DVD. It's also available streaming.
Right. A film you saw and enjoyed at Outfest.
At Outfest. It's a documentary by, oh gosh, I'm blanking on the guy's name now, Matt Wolf. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I'm bringing it up is because he has a new documentary in theaters right now called mm-hmm. Teenage.
Right.
That I haven't seen yet, but I'm going to go try to catch it this week. This was an earlier documentary from him from 2009 or something like that,
something
2010.
Like that.
Anyway, about the musician Arthur Russell, who is no longer with us, but who was this wildly eclectic musician, mostly known to the general public as a guy who made some of the weirdest, coolest disco records of the, you know, late 70s, early 80s. He was a fascinating guy. He was like completely out of time and place, this person. His strange, you know, thoughtful, genius, stoner, gay dude who was, you know, had his hand in every kind of music. He was in the same world as, like, David Byrne, Talking Heads, and Philip Glass, but he was mostly well known for making club music at that, you know, at that point in history. And if you know the song, Is It All Over My Face? Sing a little of Is It All Over My Face, Alonzo.
It's hard to get the notes right.
Come on. It's hard to get the notes right because it's always hard to get the notes right.
Is it all over my face?
It's more like this. Is it all over my face? Like, there's no...
It's intentionally atonal, the song.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a great song.
And Russell,
Is It All Over My Face?
Russell's music is also featured in How to Survive the Plague.
Yes. And so, and I don't want to lean too heavily on the club music stuff, because he did all kinds of stuff.
Yes.
All kinds of really fascinating, cool, strange music.
Avant-garde compositions.
Yeah. And it was a great documentary.
It is, yeah. I knew almost nothing about Arthur Russell when I saw it. I found it really fascinating.
Got letters.
We got letters.
We got a lot of them. We got so many, we're not going to finish reading them, all of them.
Okay.
Several of them were directed not just to the podcast, but to me directly.
Mm, well,
because of my review of God's Not Dead that is up now on linoleum-knife.com.
Your written review.
My written review.
Our discussion of it on the podcast.
Now, if you think you're going to find all my reviews on movies.com, you are not. You're going to find my reviews of bigger movies on movies.com, but this one is on linoleum-knife.com.
I knew we were forgetting something. Weren't you going to review the new Chiming Lang movie this week?
I'm not going to talk about that this week because the written review is going to go up this week.
Oh,
and
okay.
Then I'll talk about
it. So, yeah, later. So check out linoleum-knife.com.
Because that's not getting a normal release anyway, so
right,
it's,
right.
It's not
time sensitive.
Time sensitive, yeah. This is from someone named Gale, G-A-L-E. I don't know if that's a male or female Gale. I'm going to assume it's a guy, because that's how you usually spell the male Gale.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I want to see this movie or not, but that review was boring, long-winded, and that review was a boring, long-winded rant that couldn't get to the point of explaining why this movie is, quote, not just bad filmmaking, but bad Christianity. Now, that is a quote from me. I say in the review that it is not merely bad filmmaking, it is also bad Christianity.
For reasons that are clear, if you've actually read the review,
yeah, if you
and paid
read
attention,
the review, and he clearly did read the review because
he got
he's
to the
quoting
end.
Me, yeah. He says, I'll have to find a review that is just about this movie, not about the author's own angst against Christianity. Parentheses, S-I-C, closed parentheses. I give this review 1-star review for at least honoring rules of grammar. Okay, so here's what's up, Gail. You're probably not listening to this podcast. You go back and read my review again, because I make my point. I'm open to people telling me that I have not made my point. But I think I did. I think I did it quite a bit. Now, here's where he was right. It was long-winded. That movie review is like 1,000 words. Probably also boring.
No.
I'm just going to give boring the benefit of the doubt.
It's subjective.
I'm going to say that, sure, I was boring. But 1,000 words doesn't take but like 10 minutes to read, first of all. So, if you're bored for 10 minutes,
you're not reading moving, my review. If you're not moving your lips.
Yeah. If you're bored reading my review, so be it. I don't believe it was particularly ranty.
Yeah.
Although I do, you know, goof on some things. Such as Carly Rae Jepsen and Beethoven. It matters. So, this review of my review, I too give 1 star. Here's another thing. There's no such thing as angst against something.
No.
That's not how you use that word. So,
And you don't even have...
angst against anything.
No.
Yeah. The end. That's what I think of your letter, Gail.
Thanks for writing in.
This is from Jordan. Thank you. I claim myself as a Christ follower, and your review made me feel gratitude for how you concluded your final paragraph. I have a feeling you have gotten some serious backlash. No, just from Gail. Seriously, just from Gail.
Hardly serious.
Anybody got some backlash for me? Bring it on! Like how Michael York said to God at the end of Megiddo 2, the Omega Code 2, or whatever it was called. And he has the big locust battle with God.
Yes.
And he says to God, bring it on! Because he's the Antichrist.
Right.
You got some backlash for me? About my God's Not Dead review? Bring it on! He says, that backlash is probably full of a lot of ignorance and bigotry and theological impudence.
You.
He goes, but I want you to know that I very much appreciated the honest words. And the way that you presented how someone who claims to love Christ should see the film. Here's another letter about God's not dead. Ugh. As a... I don't know. There are so many labels that divide our society into boxes. So we don't have to engage in thoughtful conversation with one another, but just dismiss and despise. But I digress. So as a, quote, true believer, I know a label still, I'm nauseated by everything I read about this movie, con and slightly pro. This is the type of Christian, in quotes, behavior that makes a whole lot of us, in quotes, want to cringe and hide and want to shout, I'm not one of them! Chances are, I probably have in common many of the same basic tenets of belief, but the strident, arrogant, vicious beliefs and actions shown towards, quote, non-believers is appalling and an antithesis to the life of the Christ we claim to love and follow. So there.
Yeah.
Yuck. If the reviews of this movie are accurate, then I am seriously embarrassed, and this is presumptuous, I guess, but I'm pretty sure God is embarrassed, too. One last thought here. If one doesn't believe in an omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent God, then he doesn't need your puny attempts to defend him. He needs no defense! Shamefacedly, Julie. Thanks, Julie. Dear Candyface and Moldylocks.
Oh.
So that's your name now, Moldylocks.
You're the one who inflicted mold upon me. Spores, molds, and fungus.
I just read Dave's review of Noah at movies.com and came to the startling realization that you can substitute Darren Aronofsky for Gary Indiana in the song from The Music Man. Try it now for the sake of the listeners like me who liked those recent episodes where you had to sing your own opening music. Do it.
Darren Aronofsky, Darren Aronofsky, Darren Aronofsky, that's the place that knew me when.
Then he writes, thank you, that was lovely.
You're welcome.
From James in Virginia. This is from Duncan. I think in the way that accidental slaughter is manslaughter, surely the freewheeling Dave Candyface White's accidental poisoning of Alonzo should be merely considered man poison.
You are man poison.
And now I need to go write a gay film noir called Man Poison. Thank you, Duncan.
Well, before you make it, Duncan, read The Real Truth.
Yeah. And go to nobudgetfilmschool.com.
Yes. Don't make Ricky Mastooks.
Don't make any more Ricky Mastooks. Hi, David Alonzo. I was listening to your most recent episode of the podcast this morning, and your discussion of God's Not Dead got me thinking about something. I know that one of the more common narratives about the entertainment industry is that people who are openly religious and or conservative face discrimination and bigotry from the godless liberals who run Hollywood, and therefore must keep their opinions hidden if they want to be successful. As such, films with overtly Christian or conservative messages often seem to be created by the more established actors, writers, directors, and producers who have come out as religious and or conservative, and the line often seems to be that something is a passion project and that they are risking their careers to further the cause. I don't put much stock in this persecution fantasy, but it leads me to wonder whether or not the semi-famous actors who star in these films and aren't especially known for leaning to the right take these roles because they agree with the messages that are being sent, or if it is just about a paycheck for them. If I were a Dean Cain or a Kevin Sorbo, I would probably prefer to make a Jesus movie than have a reality show or appear on the latest season of Dancing with the Stars. But that seems like a big risk for a person who is not a true believer to take if they believe that they work in an industry that ostracizes anyone who votes Republican. Do you guys think that the actors who appear in agenda-based films are sympathetic to the messages of those films, or are you more inclined to say that a job is just a job for most performers and the claims of a conservative blacklist are largely exaggerated? That letter is from Eric in Washington, D.C.
Well, I think the blacklist thing is totally exaggerated. There was just a story that I was reading today about this group called Friends of Abe that is like Hollywood conservatives who basically just duped the IRS into declaring them a 501c3 nonprofit when they're totally politically, you know, partisan, you know, group. And they deal with election stuff, which, you know, nonprofits aren't supposed to. And it claims among its membership, and I'm trying to find
Gary Sinise, Kelsey Grammer, Patricia Heaton,
David Mamet, Robert Duvall.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, there's a lot of powerful, you know, Republicans in Hollywood, and they work. And so I don't think that any of them are suffering all that greatly under any sort of blacklist. As far as whether or not these are passion gigs or they just take the job because they want the job,
it depends on the actor.
Exactly. I think if you're an up-and-comer, a gig's a gig. But
yeah.
But
the woman who plays the Muslim student in the film, she's got a lot of credits on IMDb, and she's in everything.
Yeah, you
she's
know,
in all kinds of stuff.
I think
her IMDb picture, pretty sexy.
I'm sure a lot of the, you know, supporting cast in the Atlas Shrugged movies aren't necessarily you know, objectivists. But I think if you're Kevin
Samantha Mathis,
right?
Who
knows what the leads are.
Who knows what she's about, but, you know.
Like, I know, like, Teller apparently is a big libertarian, you know, so I'm sure he intentionally, you know.
Really?
Did sign on for that because he's a believer in Ayn Rand.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I think once you're, if you're a bigger name and you're doing these movies, then yeah, you clearly do believe in the project, and you probably aren't getting paid that much because a lot of these projects are fairly low-budget films.
Right.
You're not doing it for the paycheck. You're doing it to...
I haven't heard Dean Cain say anything about this movie in public. Now, I haven't really been paying attention to him. And if he is saying anything at all...
That beats me.
Kevin Sorbo, on the other hand...
Very vocal.
He's very vocal.
Oh, Clint Eastwood...
And so he is... He's down for the struggle.
Clint Eastwood and Jerry Bruckheimer also in Friends of Abe.
Sure.
I'm sure it depends, and even in the case of Atlas Shrugged, there's probably a lot of people who were like, who took the gig because it was a gig, you know, and not necessarily to make a statement about it. But I don't believe. I mean, you know, yes, for the most part, people in the entertainment industry tend to be liberal. I think people in the arts tend to be liberal because of the way that they look at the world and the way that they have. Their compassion and empathy for other people,
right.
You know, but there are conservatives in every branch of the arts. And even if they're in the minority, I don't think they're as oppressed as they like to fantasize that they are.
Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, we're not in the industry, but obviously, you know, these the aforementioned...
Who can say?
The aforementioned members of Friends of Abe...
Let's get Patty Heaton on the show.
...wouldn't have such successful careers.
What's she doing?
You know, Mel Gibson...
She's getting ready to promote Mom's Night Out. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Yeah. Wouldn't she love to come on this show and promote Mom's Night Out with us?
She's not coming on this show.
Get a hold of her people.
I don't want her on this
show. If you know Patricia Heaton, you tell her that we love her and not Raymond. And that we want her on this podcast.
No.
I loved her in those Albertsons commercials.
No.
I could win her over with waffles. I think I can do that with just about anybody.
No. She's not my kind of Catholic.
Last week on Linoleum Knife, you wondered aloud if your listeners want to hear your interpersonal near-death interactions. Now, while I will say that the movies are an integral part of the Linoleum Knife experience, I'm betting that we all live for the spirited arguing. Example. A previous listener, male, had referred to a conversation you had on air as bickering. One of you, I don't remember who, claimed that you weren't bickering because it didn't fit your definition of bickering. That was me. Mm-hmm. I think the word bickering means arguing. And I know that's probably, you know, not fully correct, but I also know that that's kind of what people think of when they hear the word bickering.
Sure.
They think about arguing. Then the other one of you disagreed with that definition of bickering. All I could think of was, ooh, they're bickering about bickering. It's probably my top LK moment. Please continue to point your critical eyes at as many things as possible, including films, but also not films. That's from Bill in Vegas, who brings us chocolates and saffron on a regular basis.
Hooray.
Let's see. Anything more?
We had a scad of letters this week.
I know. Thank you for sparing me and my youth group the time and money I considered dropping on God Is Not Dead. Hoped it might spark some fair-handed discussion, but it sounds as pointless as the Ken Ham Bill Nye debate. Well written. That's from Justin. So apparently a youth minister either reads my reviews or listens to this show. If you are listening, Justin, we are appreciative.
I think it's because you were on Rotten Tomatoes.
I'm a youth group guy from way back. Yes. I was in many youth groups.
That's right.
As a youth, I went on mission trips with my youth group when I was a youth.
You were in a choir.
I was in the youth choir of my youth group. I was a teen baritone.
You were the one man baritone section.
I was. So
that was before you were basso profundo.
Yeah. Okay, here's a top 10 list. Dear David Alonso, your show just keeps getting better. We know. Stop. It is for this reason I have chosen to write you today, because I have been disturbed by the nitpicky, bullishy, slightly bitchy attempts to get you guys to change things up a bit. Yeah. My fellow listeners seem to lack the taste the two of you deserve.
Well,
I have heard requests to play music from MP3s, which is preposterous. I don't want you to sound like professionals.
Done and done.
All your charm is found in your wanton disregard for professionality. Yes, I know that doesn't actually sound like a compliment. Anyhow, please knife my top 10 movies of all time list as a sacrifice for the sinful nature of my linoleum brethren. Oh, that reminds me, where does your name come from? Does it have anything to do with Mastodon? Yes, it does.
Yes, it does.
We wanted a name. You wanted a name that was cinematic, and I wanted a name that was violent.
Right.
And we finally decided that the lyrics of the Mastodon song for the Aqua Teen Hunger Force movie, colon movie film for theaters, were perfect. About how if you'd misbehave in the movie, they'll cut your lips off with a linoleum knife. And that became we love the idea of cutting off lips with linoleum knives. And so this show is now called Linoleum Knife. Thank you, Aqua Teen Hunger Force, : Movie Film for Theaters, and Mastodon.
For helping us name the show. All right, what's his top 10?
Predator. Just so great. Okay. Speaking of good Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, true.
Freaked.
Oh, I love Freaked.
Yeah, me too. A Fish Called Wanda.
Great.
That Obscure Object of Desire.
Oh.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
The Conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Videodrome.
Sure.
The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Oh, yeah.
McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Ooh.
Bridge on the River Kwai. Dude, you're 100%.
Totally.
You are 100% knife. Ryan. He writes again, thank you for never changing. Best of luck in your sojourn for Raheem-level radio thumping.
That was when we were still looking
for a cassette. Player, yeah. All right, that's it. We're done.
Goodness gracious. Well, we want to thank Blue for our lovely theme music.
Yes,
you can find out more about his work at blutopia.com, BLEU. TOPIA. Check out our friends online. Go to ChristyLemire.com. If you are a SiriusXM subscriber, check out Rotten Tomatoes Radio every Tuesday and Thursday with our friends Gray Drake and Matt Atchity. Check out The Frank DeCaro Show and, of course, Derek and Romaine, where we appear every month or so. Want to thank Madeline Brand at KCRW, host of Press Play, for having us on this week.
Can you go to KCRW.com and still listen to us
on
Press Play?
Yeah, I posted a link on our Facebook page.
Nice. We were on a show on KCRW on Friday called Press Play,
mm-hmm.
and it's hosted by basically the queen of KCRW. Am I wrong about that?
She's one of their major personalities.
She's the queen of KCRW. Yes, her name is Madeline Brand, and she's groovy.
Yes.
And we were lucky enough to be on her show. Well, you've been on her show before.
Yes, but the both I was just a
fill-in.
Well,
you were on the show regularly with other film critics.
I was part of a rotation. Yeah.
And none of those other people wanted to be with you this time. And they were like, "Ooh, gross, Alonzo Doral." They know. And I was like, I guess I'll do it.
No, in the past, I have actually recommended other people. Like, I came out with Christy one time. I came out with Amy Nicholson one time. And this time, I thought, you know what? You should ask my husband, Dave White.
What about my husband, Dave White?
With whom I do this podcast.
He is sometimes a film critic.
And so we went on, and it was a lot of fun. And I hope we get to do it again.
I would like to go back on that show with you because I had a fun time. Also, we get to talk about the Gwyneth Paltrow cookbook, which is very important to me.
Yes.
And also, KCRW is the place that hosts Unfictional.
Yes.
The show that I'm on every so often. Has nothing to do with film. But if you don't know it, you go to KCRW.com.
/Unfictional.
After you listen to Press Play, the one with us on it from Friday, you go listen to me on Unfictional.
You're on, like, what, five or six different episodes?
Five or six. I'm on the live one.
Mm-hmm. The live one got broken up into like three episodes.
Right.
You're on one of those.
Yeah. I kicked out the jams on that live
one. You did.
The other ones, I listened to the other ones and I think I was fine. But on that live one,
mm-hmm.
I was kind of...
You know, when you have an audience, it makes
pretty
a difference.
Groovy. I was pretty groovy. I'm just, you know.
No, I'm very proud of you on that one.
Me too.
Check out our friends in the podcast universe, the B-Movies Podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, who had very nice things to say about our commentary tracks. If you have not purchased...
They're doing commentary tracks now too.
Well, they said they might,
but they're gonna do them for free.
Well, that's their problem.
If that's how much you think your commentaries are worth, guys, why don't we make a little competition out of this?
Just don't.
Let's not. You know what? This whole we're all comrades kind of thing is fine. Let's be competitors. Let's turn this into a blood sport.
Let's not.
Let's get the claw hammers out.
Let's not.
Let's do it.
So anyway, $1.99, our Clue commentary.
A wrestling match.
Are the Apple commentary. They're both available. You can PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Just let us know your email address and we'll get that sent to you.
You're going to buy ours.
Yes.
We're not giving that stuff away for free.
Anyway. Check out the B-Movies Podcast. Check out Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Team Jack, if he ever decides to record a new episode.
He's not. He quit.
He will. No, he's going to.
He's not going to talk again until we have him back on and make half the Lost listeners angry again.
He's on a network and everything.
Is there something that that he's got coming up that he can come back on and rile people up again over?
I think he'll do that at the drop of a hat.
I really like making our listeners angry with Jack Morrissey.
We have a lot of pro-Jack listeners, too. The Schmoes Know Film Spotting SVU Pod Crash. Sorry, that's two different shows. Film Spotting SVU, comma, Pod Crash with that Chris Gore.
Right.
The Game Night Guys, Secretly Timid, and The Lunch with our friend James Rocky. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes. And if you want to leave us a positive review there, that would be the bee's knees. You can stream the program at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com or on our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast, which if you haven't liked yet, you should totally go over there and do it. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. Check into the show at tvtag.com. And you can email us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with your questions, your comments, your top 10 lists, your 10 anything, whatever lists.
Go read my review of God's Not Dead on linoleum-knife.com.
Yes, and this week you'll also be reviewing
Stray Dogs from Chai Ming Ling. I'm going to see Teenage. I'm going to write about that.
Awesome.
So many exciting words.
Yeah.
I'll be writing for you on our site.
And go over to YouTube and check out my stuff at What the Flick on the Young Turks Network. Dave's at movies.com. I'm at therap.com. And we are out of here. Catch you next time.
Goodbye.